That's a much better choice for me, because if I choose that love is there, then there's hope. And something happens as I gradually do this. Even though we don't understand it all, there can be a realization and a kind of understanding that it's going to be okay. No proof, we can't logically figure it out, but as we start to trust ourselves to God more and trust in the love that is God, gradually this happens. It doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it's obvious, but there's the realization I can trust. It's a slow and difficult and painful experience, and I suspect we're on that journey to some degree as long as we live. As we begin to respond to the love that is in us and around us, we realize that we are called to grow in love and compassion and respect, and as we grow in that respect and compassion and love, we're happier. It doesn't mean we don't have problems. It doesn't mean we don't have suffering. It doesn't mean we don't have reversals or depressions or anything like that at all. It doesn't mean that, but we will be happier. So that's the play from the book of Job. The final thing that God says is, "Trust me. I am with you. Just trust me." And that's hard. I remember, I forget who it was, someone gave an example of what faith means. It's kind of like a rope hanging from the sky, and there's a knot at the end of the rope, and it's swinging back and forth. And you hold on to that rope with everything you've got. You just hold on. Sometimes that's all we can do. God bless you. Thorns in the Flesh, July 5, 1997. The second reading is taken from one of the letters that Paul wrote to the people of Corinth. In this letter, he wrote that he was given a thorn in the flesh so Satan could torment him. So he kept asking God to take it away. God said, "Nope, my grace is sufficient for you." Now, I can identify with this. I'm just going to talk about some personal things. And I think what really happens is that these thorns in the flesh of one kind or another that we all have, at the time we're going through them, they seem all terrible and evil and bad, and we don't want anything to do with them. But sometimes we can look back and see the place that they had, and that God was able to use these things to make us better people. I'm going to talk about three thorns. Paul only had one. I've got three thorns. The first one is fear. Fear has been something that has plagued me all my life. I have some understanding where this came from. I remember when I was about 3 years old, I was scared of the vacuum cleaner. I called it the Bam Bam. I remember being scared of this, and I don't know who it was, but somebody laughed at me for being scared. What happens with something like that is the emotion gets frozen. There's another time when I had a brother who was 3 years older than me. He died when I was three. Shortly after that, I was walking down the street, and I can still see myself and my dad. I was about so big, and he was real tall. And he was talking about his son, my brother Carl, who had died, and he said, "See that house over there?" He said, "If Carl Kenneth were standing on that roof, and I was down below, and I said, 'Carl Kenneth, jump and I'll catch you,' he would jump." I remember that I didn't say anything at all. I was saying to myself, "I'd never do that. I'd be too scared to do that." And so I thought I wasn't as good as my brother, and that my dad didn't think as much of me as he did of him. So fear has been something I've had to cope with. It's fear of failure, fear of conflict, fear that people wouldn't like me, fear of authority, all those different kinds of things. A second thorn, integrating my sexuality, has been a real hard struggle. I don't think that's terribly unusual, but it's been a real hard struggle. And I can trace some of that back, too. I remember when I was about 6 years old, I was sexually abused. It's very vague in my mind. I remember parts of it, and then it kind of gets into a blank, and I can't remember it. So I'm sure that had a big part to do with this struggle. Also, I remember that in the parish school, sex equaled sin. I got that starting in the first grade. If it was sexual, it was sin. That put a fear inside. The idea of celibacy didn't help that any either, because remember, I would see sex as sin. So I thought if sex is bad, I guess celibacy must be good. And of course this meant that if you wanted to be a priest, you had to take the baggage along with you. I think being celibate is a great way for some people to live. For other people, it's not a good way to live. And I believe it's terribly destructive to our church if celibacy is required for priesthood. I think it's great if there are celibate priests. It's great if there are married priests. We need them all. So integrating my sexuality has been a hard thorn in the flesh. The last one I'll mention is depression. What I most associate with depression is feeling hopeless, helpless, and lonely. The helplessness was really very hard. I couldn't do anything. I remember in one of my depressions, I could hardly stand up to say Mass, and preaching was just terrible. Oh, because I felt so helpless. So these have been things, among others, which have been very difficult for me. And going through them seemed awful and terrible at the time. I would have given anything not to go through them, because when you're in it, you don't see the end. You just see the terrible stuff you're going through. As I look back, I see that all these things had a place. They had a place. There's some way that God used these things. I don't think God gave them to me. I don't believe that. But they're part of what happened to me through the whole period of my life, and God was able to use them. I believe the goal of the spiritual life is to become compassionate people. And I believe suffering is the instrument that engraves compassion deeply in our hearts. If we never suffered, we would never be compassionate. And if we were never compassionate, we would miss what the goal of the spiritual life is. It's very easy for me to talk about this stuff when I'm out of it. When I'm in it, that's another story. And even though I have the experience of these kinds of things, when I'm in a tough place, it still feels awful. I would imagine this is something Paul was talking about too. If we can be open to the grace of God, as we hit these things and suffer through them and endure them and curse at them or whatever it's going to be, we can keep in mind that there very well could be a purpose behind them. It doesn't make it simple. It doesn't make it easy. It doesn't mean we want it. But it is some help to realize as we go through it that when we look back on it, we can see perhaps why it happened. It's like that poem, Footprints. Where were you, God? See, there's only one set of footprints there. Where were you? He says, that was when I carried you. God bless you. Control and Love, August 21, 1997. This weekend we have the last of the five readings from the sixth chapter of John about the meditations on the Eucharist. This is where we celebrate Jesus, what Jesus did, and what Jesus taught. Particularly, we celebrate Jesus' fundamental belief that under Abba, our God, all people are equal. Nobody's over anybody else. And then we look first of all at how in our history for the last 5 or 6,000 years our society has generally been organized with some people over other people, with some people in control and some people to be controlled. Jesus said this is not right. We are all equal before God. This is not the way that we are to be structured. In fact, Jesus said, if you're going to be number one in my kingdom, it means you've got to be a servant of the rest. So you can't be dominant over anybody and follow what Jesus says. Jesus' teachings lasted for about 20 or 30 years, and then very quickly the church got right back into the old kinds of things. In particular, with the coming of Constantine, you could hardly tell the church structure from the civil structure. So we look at how the equality Jesus preached speaks about the equality of women and men. We also talk about children and how children need to be disciplined, nurtured, and guided. Equality brings out the truth that they must be respected. The fact that they are little and the fact that they are young does not diminish their value as human beings one iota. Last time we talked about the images of God and how our images of God need to be both feminine and masculine, because in our society, masculine traits are one-sided and feminine traits are one-sided. So if we use only masculine traits of God, we get a one-sided view of God. If we use only feminine traits and characteristics of God, our notion of God is lopsided too. We need to have both of them together. Today we're going to look at how this equality that Jesus talks about is absolutely necessary if we're going to love. When there isn't equality, love does not take place. I think we can look at this particularly from the idea of controlling. When we control, what does it mean? I get somebody to do what I want. Isn't that true? That is just the opposite of love. Love always sets people free. What does love want? When I love someone, I want them to become who they really are. I want them to become the person God made them to be. And if I'm able to provide some kind of nurturing and helping environment for that, that is great. But you see, when I control, I do not allow freedom. And when I do not allow freedom, I am not loving. We need to think about this. This is why if one is the head of the other, it doesn't work. This is why the reading from the Ephesians, where we hear that the husband is the head of the wife, is contrary to what Jesus was talking about. This letter was written after the teaching of Jesus no longer permeated the church. Now, there are different ways of controlling. Some are straightforward and some are sneaky. I usually try to be sneaky. I'm too scared to be straightforward, so I usually try to control by being sneaky. There are different ways of controlling. One is by physical force. I'm bigger, tougher, and stronger than you are, and I can make you do what I want you to do, or I'll pound you. It's pretty obvious there's no love there. I just want you to do what I want you to do. There's no freedom allowed, no space that's allowed. Sometimes it's not the use of physical force, or maybe it is, because it's the threat of physical force. If I've got you subdued enough, and I've beat you enough times, all I've got to do is look at you, and you know what you're going to get. And so I control by the threat that physical force will be used. Those are fairly obvious kinds of things. There are other ways of controlling, too, that are more subtle. These are emotional ways of controlling, like saying, if you don't act the way I want you to act, I will leave you. And if you fear being abandoned, you're going to conform. You see, that's not letting a person be free. Controlling is done in another way, by using shame and guilt. This is just another way to manipulate people. If I can shame you and guilt you, that's one way that I can get you to do what I want. See, I'm over you by the use of the shame and the guilt. I'm dominating you, even though it's a more subtle way than using my fists. But it's the same kind of thing. When I use shame and guilt, I'm not loving you. I'm not helping you grow. Shame and guilt make it difficult or impossible to grow. The more I shame you, the less chance you have to grow in goodness. The more I make you feel guilty, the less chance you have to grow spiritually. So when anybody in your family, and this does happen in families, shames or guilts you, don't take it on. If any church leaders shame or guilt you, don't take it on. There is no love there. It's control. And the more I control, the less I love. They are opposites. See what Jesus was talking about. Why it's so important to Jesus that we be equal, that nobody be over somebody else, and higher than somebody else, and dominant over somebody else. Jesus says, that is not the way it is in my kingdom. If you're going to see things through my eyes, the way Abba sees them, the way it's supposed to be, you're not going to have some people over other people. This is very fundamental, what Jesus was talking about. So don't let anybody shame or guilt you. But it's hard not to, especially if we picked it up when we were little. If I am in a position of authority, man, if you've been shamed and guilted as a child, I can really get you. I can threaten you with hell. I can shame you that you're a bad person. I can send the message, you're no good and you're awful and there's something wrong with you unless you shape up and do the things I want you to. That's hard to resist because you're vulnerable. We're all especially vulnerable because we learned the shame and guilt when we were little. I have a question that I think probably almost everybody has. Why doesn't God do something about all the troubles and evils of the world, and the wars, and the afflictions, and diseases, and stuff like this? I'm going to suggest that the reason God does not change these things, does not step in and stop them, is because God is a lover and not a controller. Controllers fix. Lovers allow freedom. Lovers walk with a person and help them know they're cared for, they're valuable, they're good. But lovers don't fix it. Lovers don't control. To the degree that we are controllers, to that degree we are not lovers. God is love. All that God is love. So God is not a controller. We can take a look at this, too. I have free will. I can do terrible things to myself and other people. Does God step in and stop it? No. God doesn't control. It's interesting, I just learned this in the last year or so, that not only is there freedom in human beings, but there is freedom in the universe. It's not like the whole universe is planned and mapped out and going to go a certain kind of way. There's randomness in the universe, a certain amount of different kinds of possibilities. The universe does not necessarily go one way or the other. There's a kind of freedom. Not the same kind of freedom we have as human beings, but a certain freedom, which again exemplifies that God is a lover, not a controller. It's hard for us when we love somebody not to fix things. Very, very hard. Probably hard for God, too. When God sees us getting into all kinds of messes, ruining our lives, ruining other people's lives, that must hurt God's heart, and God must cry. But loving is more important, and that love will win. Not tomorrow, not next year, but that love, the most powerful thing in the universe, will finally win. That's one of the reasons we say God is love. Love doesn't make everything nice right away, but in the long run, there's nothing as powerful as love. God bless you. Allowing God to enter us, September 6, 1997. I'd like to start by reflecting on Mother Teresa a little bit. There are two ways we can look at her. One is to say that she was truly a remarkable woman, and that's true. I also would suggest that Mother Teresa was very ordinary. What God accomplished in Mother Teresa, God intends to accomplish in each one of us. All that Mother Teresa was someone who was willing to let God change her and transform her. And if we will allow God to change and transform us, it's not as remarkable or unusual as we might think. You see, the beginning of the spiritual life, the first stones, are the healing of the wounds inside of us. Because of those wounds, we resist God. We resist allowing God to enter into us and change us, to transform us. That's why we end up so much different from Mother Teresa. But if we allow God to do that, and it's painful because it means changing and letting go of some things, if we allow God to do that, what Mother Teresa has been is just an example of what all of us are called to be. In the Gospel today, Jesus gives a deaf man hearing. I think we can understand this on a deeper level than the hearing, the natural physical hearing, which was cured. Deeper than this is that the power of God can help us to hear what God says. And what does God say to us? I love you. You're beautiful. You're good. You're holy. You're the apple of my eye. I'm delighted in you. You are a wonderful, beautiful person. Now that's what God is whispering in our ear all the time. But they're static, and because they're static, we don't hear it. The static comes from the different messages we get. Those of you who are old enough to remember when we had radio, without boomboxes, you know, the static got so bad that we didn't hear what was being said. And that's exactly what happens. Let's look at some of the static that we get. We get static from our families. We get static from our society. We get static from our religion. And these statics keep the message of God from coming into us. We don't hear it. It's drowned out and it's distorted. And so we do not begin the spiritual journey. We do not allow God to do in us what God did in Mother Teresa. Let's take a look at some of this stuff. maybe we got this at home. Are you ever stupid? You're never going to amount to anything. Why don't you get good grades like your sister? Or be more like your brother? What is the matter with you? I guess I should never have had you. We'd all be much better off. Those are voices that started when we were very young, and those voices pounding in our ear keep us from hearing what God is saying. So we don't hear God saying, I love you, you're good, you're beautiful, you're holy, you're precious to me. What do we hear? Those other voices saying, there's something wrong with you, you're stupid, you're no good, you're never going to amount to anything. I wish I never had you. That's what we hear, and that wounds us extremely deeply. Because we can't hear what God is saying, we don't get transformed. That is why it is so important at the beginning of the spiritual life that these wounds heal. It starts to reduce the static, and as the static is reduced, the power of God's words and love comes into us and transforms us. There are other kinds of things, too, that hurt us. We get hurts, you know, from different kinds of beatings and slappings, from sexual abuse. We get hurts from being abandoned for various reasons. Maybe we went to the hospital when we were little. Sometimes things happen before we're out of the womb, and these abandonments, these hurts and abuses that we get, wound us. They're like static. Do you see what those wounds say to us? There's something the matter with you. You're not okay. There's something wrong with you. You're a mixed-up, flawed person down in deep. That's what we hear. When we've been abandoned, we hear that we can't trust anybody. We didn't get the love we were supposed to get. We didn't get touched. When babies don't get touched, they get emotionally twisted. We need touch all through our lives, especially when we're tiny. That's the only way we get the message. What, for example, if the baby cries and cries and cries and nobody picks her up? What's the message to the baby? This is a cruel, hostile world. You can't trust anybody. Your needs will never get met. And that static resounds in our ears. I remember my mom saying to me, she said, you know, John, when you were little, the doctors all said, don't spoil the child. If the baby cries, let the baby cry it out. If you pick the baby up and comfort the baby will be spoiled. You don't want a spoiled child. She said, well, I knew the doctors had to be right because they were smart, you know. They knew all this kind of stuff. But then she said, sometimes I did it anyway. How many of us went through that? We don't even remember it that much. But those messages got through. When God says, trust me, I love you, if we were not picked up, the voice is saying, you can't trust anybody. You can't trust anybody. Drown out the voice of God. We get static from our society. Our society says, if you're going to be happy, you must really be rich and you must really be successful. If you get enough money, if you have enough insurance policies, if you have all this kind of stuff and you're a successful person, then you'll be happy. And what happens is that these messages we get when we're older hook into the messages we got when we were little. Because there's an emptiness, a hole inside of us because of what happened. And so we think, oh, I can fill up the hole if I get enough money. I can fill up the hole if I'm a successful and famous person. And so we strive for that. Understandably, we strive for that because the hole hurts so bad. The pain is so deep, we'll reach out for anything. Just like a drowning person, we'll reach for anything for survival. Only it doesn't work. These messages of our society wound us deeply. So very deeply because they hook into the holes that were dug when we were little. Alas, religion wounds us too. We think, oh, religion will be the answer. Baloney. It might be, it might not be. Religion can be terribly, terribly destructive. It's terribly destructive when it gives us messages of God that are false. God is the judge, the tyrant, the policeman. God knows everything you do and everything you think. And if you're even thinking the wrong things, if you enjoy it, you're going to go to hell. And we build guilt and we build shame. This is static. This is static that keeps us from hearing the voice of God. When religion is destructive, run away. Run away fast. Religion can be wonderful. It can be an angel or a devil. So watch the messages that you get from religion. The message, you're a terrible, sinful person, means you're no good inside. And the voice of God saying, you're wonderful and precious and good, can't get through. Because the voice of religion is so strong and such terrible static, it interferes with the voice of God. See all that junk we've got to go through? That's why we end up being such messes. Mother Teresa had her junk. I don't know what her childhood was, but she had her junk too. I'm sure she was severely wounded, like all of us. But somehow, she was able at one point to allow God to heal her. And that is the first step. That's why you hear this message from me over and over and over again. And you're going to keep hearing it for the next 10 years. Because that is the first step in the spiritual life. It's the healing of the wounds, so the static is gradually lessened. And as the static is lessened, the love, the word that is God, can come into us and start to change us and transform us. What Mother Teresa became is what God has in mind for every single one of us. God bless you. Intimacy with Jesus, May 6, 1990. The gospel story today has the familiar image of Jesus as the Good Shepherd. This particular passage reminds us of the very close and intimate relationship to which Jesus calls us. The shepherd knows each one of the lambs by name. It's not just the whole flock. Each one is an individual to him. This reminds us that Jesus thinks in this way too. Each one of us, as an individual, is important and recognized by Jesus. Jesus does not want to be a stranger to us. He wants us to become close and intimate friends. One of the dimensions of the spiritual journey is a close and intimate personal relationship with Jesus. This doesn't happen automatically. When people are friends, they have to have something to do with each other. They talk, share their hopes and dreams and fears. In other words, do things in a close, intimate fashion before they become deeper friends. It's the same way with Jesus, too. Unless we do this, it is not likely that we will ever have that kind of intimate relationship with Jesus. There are various ways we can do it, but we each have to find our own kind of way. I'll give you some suggestions of ways to deepen that intimacy with Jesus. Some of us might take a passage of Scripture. Let's use the example of the Good Shepherd. We often see the picture where Jesus has a little lamb over his shoulder and is carrying him back to the flock. Maybe we can imagine that Jesus is holding us. We might do this, particularly at times when we feel lost or depressed. Jesus picks us up and carries us home. We might use the image of Jesus doing that for us. We might also choose the image, particularly when we are sad or hurt, that Jesus is holding us and we cry. As we cry, Jesus holds us and says, I love you. I understand your pain. I cannot take it all away, but I will help you through it. Perhaps we could say the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father, and imagine that we are sitting with Jesus saying this prayer together, because God is Jesus' Father too. Maybe we also want to bring some other people into that image, people who are especially close to us. We are all saying it together. Perhaps it would work better without images. Maybe we just want to spend some time in the presence of God, in the presence of Jesus. In whatever situation we put ourselves, we just try to be as real as we can. In the presence of Jesus, we offer our hurts, our flaws, and our sins, and the things that don't make sense to us. We offer our angers, our frustrations, our resentments, and our hatreds. We offer warm and fuzzy things, happy things in our lives, our joys, whatever things are in us. For some of us, it might help if we do this as we breathe, as we are quiet. It's like taking all that is in us, things that we think are good and bad, whatever they might be, and as we breathe in, we are giving them all to Jesus. As we breathe out, we imagine that the power and the love of God is going through all these things that we have given to him to make them well. We all have to find our own kind of way. We have to experiment. We have to practice. It can't be done just by reading a book. but I would encourage everyone to try to find some way of doing it. As we do it, our insides become healed. It doesn't mean there are no problems, no pain or sorrow, or that all these negative things are taken away. That's not true, but we do become healed. We become deeper and more grace-filled people. For some of us, healing may happen this way. For others, it may happen in small groups where people share their faith. But I would encourage everyone to find some way to allow this to happen to them. This is one very important element of our whole spiritual journey and growth. Jesus wants us to be on intimate terms with Him, not just someone far off in the sky. As this healing takes place within us, as we become more graceful with the power of God within us, then we will move on to works of justice and works of peacemaking, but we will do them in a different kind of way, because we are not doing them just by our own power, but more by the power of God working through us, the power of God that is formed inside of us through our intimate relationship with Jesus. That power will enable us to be very strong, but that at the same time very gentle. That power will enable us to be as wise as serpents and as simple as doves. We will be able to be very clear and honest, and at the same time respectful. We will have very strong opinions and convictions, but we will also be humble. Our works of justice and peacemaking, when they grow out of the power of God developing and growing inside of us, have a different character. They lose none of their strength. In fact, their strength may be greater. They lose none of their clarity, honesty, or conviction. Those things may be even deeper. There's a change because there is humility, respect, and gentleness coming from the power of God working within us. This wraps up the spiritual journey. On the inward journey, we grow in deep intimacy. On the outward journey, we make a difference in our world. God bless you.